From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As President Clinton says he'll push again for trade privileges for China, we'll hear from Arthur Miller, Rose Styron, and Peter Gabriel about one of many Chinese dissidents who remains in jail. Then the court-martial of the first female B-52 pilot begins today. She's charged with adultery. Also, a review of the military's plans for the 21st century. Whatever happened to the peace dividend? And what's the size of the spy budget? We'll speak with a research group suing the CIA to find out. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. African states are lining up to recognize new Nigerian leader Laurent Kabila. We should say new Congolese leader Laurent Kabila, following the victory over the weekend of his Alliance of Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Congo Zaire. Messages of recognition broadcast on state radio in Uganda and Zambia coincided with similar statements by regional states Rwanda, Kenya, Burundi, and Botswana. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni said he hoped the alliance victory will bring closer ties between the two countries in a message on state-run Uganda radio monitored by the British Broadcasting Corporation. Uganda publicly declared its support for the rebels near the start of a seven-month campaign, but consistently denied providing direct military assistance. Rwanda's government, which also backed the rebels but denies supporting them militarily, saluted Kabila's victory. South Africa recognized the new government over the weekend. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, touring Jewish settlements in the West Bank today, dismissed as groundless reports that a U.S. study showed more than a quarter of settler homes are empty. Israel's Haaretz Daily said today Washington, citing U.S. data showing a large number of homes lying vacant, believed any expansion of Jewish settlements was unnecessary. The settlement issue has taken center stage in a crisis in PLO-Israel talks deadlocked since March, when Netanyahu broke ground on a new Jewish enclave in Arab East Jerusalem. Here in this country, Harvard researchers are saying secondhand cigarette smoke is more dangerous than previously thought. They're reporting this today in a study with broad implications for public health policy and probable direct impact on at least one major lawsuit. The 10-year study, which tracked more than 32,000 healthy women who never smoked, has found that regular exposure to other people smoking at home or work almost doubled the risk of heart disease. Many earlier studies have linked secondhand smoke to heart disease, but the new findings show the biggest increase in risk ever reported, and the researchers say that it applies equally to men and women. This news from Wilmington, North Carolina. A white man has pleaded guilty to hurling gasoline-filled beer bottles at a rural black church and setting it on fire last summer. Matthew Neil Blackburn, who is 19 years old, of Stella, North Carolina, admitted yesterday to using explosives to commit a felony and malicious destruction in the June 30th fire at St. James AME Zion Baptist Church. Blackburn, who is attending Catawba College on a soccer scholarship before his arrest, will be sentenced next month. He faces up to 30 years in prison. The Friendly's family restaurant chain agreed to make its 704 eateries more handicapped accessible within 6 years, in a settlement affecting more restaurants than any other reached by the Justice Department. Attorney General Janet Reno said 49 million Americans with disabilities will benefit from the deal, the largest the Justice Department has negotiated under the Americans with Disabilities Act. The slogan "Destroy All Girls" is spelling trouble for a California maker of inline skating clothing and equipment. The Senate Company put the slogan on its clothing laundry tags. A customer of Galleon's Trading Company, a sporting goods chain, called to complain after she spotted the slogan on a T-shirt. In response, Galleon's is pulling Senate's fall line of T-shirts, sweatshirts, pants, and boxer shorts. One of the owners of Senate says the slogan is not to be taken literally. Arlo Eisenberg jokes that Senate originally planned to put "Kill Your Parents" on the tags, but some people thought that was too extreme. Eisenberg says Senate sold about $10 million in goods last year, primarily to teenage boys who skate aggressively. In the first of four straight executions planned in Texas this week, a carpenter who killed three people with a claw hammer quietly went to his death. Richard Drinker declined to say anything before being executed last night. Members of his family and the victim's family watched the execution and declined to speak with reporters. Clarence Lackey was set for lethal injection this evening for the July 1977 abduction, fatal beating, and rape of a Lubbock woman. Similar executions are scheduled for Wednesday and Thursday. A retired baker who was a concentration camp guard for Nazis will be deported for taking Jews and others on a death march to Auschwitz during World War II, this according to government prosecutors. The deportation order for Nicholas Schiffer came from immigration judge John Gossert, who said the 78-year-old Philadelphia native tormented prisoners at three concentration camps in Germany and Poland. Schiffer, who admitted to being a guard but denied knowing of the atrocities within the camps, will be deported to Romania. A spontaneous reaction of two chemicals stored in a tank apparently caused last week's explosion at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation's defunct plutonium processing plant. Both chemicals were once used at the building to recover plutonium from waste materials produced at Hanford. And finally, a report says refugees around the world are having a harder time finding asylum than ever before. That's one reason why the flow of refugees, asylum seekers, and other displaced people around the world is at a 7-year low. But there are still 34 million refugees globally in 1996. A private group, the U.S. Committee for Refugees, says the U.S. and Germany are among 15 countries named where guarantees of political asylum have deteriorated. And you're listening to Democracy Now! President Clinton yesterday began a campaign to renew most favored nation trade status with China. Perhaps most appropriately, he began it in a meeting with business executives. The move comes as no surprise following yet another lobbying blitz of what is now referred to as the China lobby, major corporations like Boeing, Coca-Cola, and Motorola. But most favored nation trade status must be approved by Congress, and opponents of the measure have vowed a tough fight. Human rights groups say that the Clinton administration has once again sacrificed support of basic freedoms on the altar of commerce. Last week in Los Angeles, New York, Portland, and Seattle, human rights groups and writers highlighted the case of Chinese author and dissident Wei Jingsheng. He's considered the leader and symbol of the ongoing struggle for democracy and human rights in China, and has spent all but 6 months of the last 17 years in prison. Once an electrician at the Beijing Zoo, Wei Jingsheng emerged as an eloquent and fearless fighter for individual rights in China during the Democracy Wall movement of the late 1970s. He was let out briefly when China was pushing to be the host of the next Olympic Games, but then he is now serving a 14-year sentence, put back in prison on round-the-clock surveillance, and his health has continued to deteriorate. Last week at the New York Public Library, hundreds gathered to honor Wei Jingsheng and a new book that's been published of his prison writings. It's called The Courage to Stand Alone, and it was published by Viking Press. The MC of the event was Kati Martin, who is chair of the Committee to Protect Journalists. She introduced some of the luminaries who were there to read Wei's work and to talk about the man.
Our first speaker is rarely silent in the face of human rights abuses. Arthur Miller, the renowned playwright, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 16 plays, including Death of a Salesman and The Crucible, has also written two novels, several collections of reportage, and a memoir. Mr. Miller.
The Chinese government has decided, in its wisdom, to draw the soul out of a man and then to try to jam it back into him with totally different opinions and views of himself and the world. Having failed to accomplish this extraordinary feat with a sentence of 18 years, they slapped him with another sentence of 17 years. If he won't accept a new soul, the solution is to murder him and the one he was born with by depriving him of proper food and medical care. And that is what they have been doing. I have worked in China as the director of Death of a Salesman, and I learned to respect and value greatly my friendships with Chinese people. I'm convinced that for most of them by far, this horrifying treatment of this man is a travesty of the revolution and a denial of the norms of civilized society. Wei Jingsheng's agony is the agony of every man and woman who understands that to be human is to be free to speak one's thoughts. Whether such protests as this can move Beijing, it is vital that the man's incalculable courage not be greeted by indifference. I believe Wei Jingsheng speaks for all of us in his insistence at the risk of his life that truth is not a trivial, dispensable thing. In our most unheroic of times, a hero has risen again. Thank you.
Thank you, Arthur Miller. Peter Gabriel is almost as well known as a human rights campaigner as he is a musician. Gabriel was the founder of the band Genesis, and over the last 20 years, he's pursued a solo career in music. He's all the while retained an active role in the human rights field and has worked closely with Amnesty International in championing human rights and organized many benefits around the world. Peter will be the first of several people who will read some of the letters of Wei Jingsheng, available to us in English because of the quite remarkable translation by Christina Torgerson. Peter?
In your country, you say human rights conditions are the consequences of cultural traditions, the social system, and historical changes. Did you think that in other countries they just fell out of the sky? Your internal affairs will bear no interference. But do you think other countries welcome your interference in their internal affairs? All this goes to show that the theory of different standards does not hold water because you have no way of proving that your laws and policies are of a reasonable standard, while those of others are not. In order to prove that yours are reasonable, you would have to cite more objective standards. We can also see that although the safeguarding of human rights and basic freedoms depends on legislation and policy enforcement on the part of sovereign states, human rights themselves have objective standards that cannot be modified by legislation and cannot be changed by the will of any government. Human rights issues pertain to how a government protects and respects the rights of its individual citizens, not how reasonable the government is in its actions. These issues have to do with how to protect the relatively weak rights of individuals under the relatively strong organs of power. They are common objective standards which apply to all governments and all individuals, and no one is entitled to special standards. Like objective existence and objective laws, they are objective truths. That was why Rousseau called them natural rights. These natural rights are not protected by heaven, as your bootlicking hack propagandists try to argue, but are rights with which every person is born. They are things that we fight for as a matter of course, and we don't need to be taught by hostile countries and hostile forces to do so. They are the natural laws and the rights of life, just like eating or having sex. In other words, they are instinctive, and that is why they're called natural. It is abominable sophistry to try and argue that people can do without food because there are some people who have nothing to eat, or that people can do without sex because there are widows and bachelors around. It is similarly abominable to argue that people do not need human rights because they are able to adapt to an animal-like existence, or that there is no such thing as objective human rights standards simply because dictatorial slave societies still exist.
Thank you very much, Peter. Liu Xing is the chairman of the Human Rights in China, a leading pro-democracy activist since the Democracy Wall movement of 1978-1979. He too was a prisoner in China for more than 10 years. for the crime, if crime it is, of publishing the transcript of Wei Jingsheng's 1979 trial. He wrote the preface to the current edition, The Courage to Stand Alone. He will speak in Chinese, and his remarks will be translated by Professor Perry Link of Princeton University.
魏晋生对民主运动的影响和作用总是与他遭受的迫害如影相伴。79年第一次被判处15年重刑，是因为他在民主墙前指出，中国要实现四个现代化，必须进行第五个现代化，即民主化。依靠人民支持上台的邓小平
Wei Jingsheng's profound meaning to China's democracy movement has been inseparable from the persecution that he has suffered. In 1979, his first heavy prison sentence resulted from his claim that Deng Xiaoping's four modernizations were doomed unless a fifth, democracy, were added. But Deng, who relied on popular support during his climb to power, preferred to rule as a dictator after reaching the top. The results of Deng's dictatorship are plainly visible in today's China, where uncontrollable corruption in government has led to outrage and deep cynicism in the public. This picture vindicates Wei Jingsheng's early warning. Human rights and democratic government are indeed necessary for China's modernization. Wei's second heavy prison sentence came in 1995, when, after the Chinese government had briefly released him in an attempt to win the right to host the Olympic Games, Wei emerged from prison undaunted and undiminished, still speaking out for democracy and human rights. To China's Democrats, who were just then re-emerging after the shock of the 1989 massacres, Wei's words brought new courage. To China's dictators, they brought renewed fear. The effects of Wei's persecution have rippled far beyond his particular case. After his first conviction in 1979, the Chinese government rounded up democracy advocates throughout China, sentenced them in secret, and sent them into prison labor camps. After his second conviction in 1995, another large group of dissidents, including Wang Dan, Liu Nianchun, Li Hai, Chen Longde, Liu Xiaobo, and Fu Guoyong, one by one were picked up and sent to prison or to labor camps. Both of these repressions caused Wei Jingsheng, as the first and most conspicuous victim, to be seen as a symbol for the whole. Such an effect is, moreover, part of the intention of the Chinese government, whose aim in persecuting dissidents is not just to curtail the activity of a few people, but to intimidate the broader democracy movement that has struggled along now for nearly 20 years, despite constant pressure, intermittent battering, and even massacre. The persecution of Wei Jingsheng and other dissidents shows as clearly as anything can that China lacks the freedoms of thought, speech, and assembly that are promised in the country's constitution. The persecution of Wei and other dissidents is also an index of the world community's regard for human rights. Wei's second prison sentence in 1995 drew even less international protest than did his first in 1979. This weak response is part of the conservative and recumbent posture that the international community has taken toward human rights in recent times. Some of the world's strongest democracies have surrendered to the Chinese government's policy of moving human rights out of the arena of action and into mere dialogue, where the exchange of words is supposed to soften Chinese dictators on questions of human rights. The actual result of this policy has been that each side pronounces its own words while the Chinese government's suppression of human rights continues and the despicable treatment of Wei Jingsheng and other dissidents achieves a kind of acceptance. Physical disease has become Wei Jingsheng's most recent adversary, yet he is denied even diagnostic medical care. Wei Jingsheng and other dissidents speak for the rights and the dignity of all Chinese people. To persecute these dissidents is to repress the rights and the dignity of all. Before the international community abandons its concern for human rights in China, it should remember that one in every five people in the world is Chinese. If the rights of so many are not important enough in themselves, then we should consider what it means for world peace and security when the government of such a large country shows brazen disregard for values and standards that the world generally shares. The international community, and especially America, must not allow the Chinese government's bravado and its threats about withholding purchase orders to lead to attenuation or even abandonment of concern and support for dissidents like Wei Jingsheng. To do so is to give up on helping 1.2 billion people to build a faith in world values and standards. We who have worked on Wei Jingsheng's book fervently hope that it will revive the world's respect, sympathy, and support for Wei and other Chinese dissidents and will dispel the present mood of indifference toward their painful circumstances and fate.
And that was Liu Qing, chair of human rights in China. He was imprisoned in China for 10 years after publishing the transcript of Wei's 1979 trial. Again, this event took place at the New York Public Library last week, as did events around the country. Hundreds of people gathered to celebrate Wei Jingsheng, who is currently serving a 19-year sentence. His book, just published by Viking, is called The Courage to Stand Alone, Letters from Prison and Other Writings. We'll be back here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, here with my co-host, New York Daily News columnist Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Thank you, Amy. Good day to you and to all the listeners.
I like your column in the New York Daily News today, which is a piece about something that's going on in New York but has been going on around the country, which is the issue of rent control.
Yes, the battle over the elimination of rent control in New York City, the last bastion, actually, of government control of rents. Boston eliminated, or Massachusetts eliminated, rent control in 1994, and as a result, in Boston alone, about 16,000 people are being forced out of their apartments, of some 80,000 who were decontrolled. California decontrolled it a few years ago, and now New York City, which has 2.7 million people living in rent-stabilized or controlled apartments, is facing the possible elimination of controls. There's a big tenant march in Albany, the state capital, today, as tenants all around the city are organizing to beat back this attempt.
And we will see what happens in New York. There is a Republican governor, George Pataki, as well as a Republican mayor, Rudolph Giuliani.
And a Republican state senate.
Well, we're going to move to a different issue right now, and it is the issue of Kelly Flynn. The court-martial trial of the country's first female B-52 bomber pilot, Lieutenant Kelly Flynn, looks set to begin in North Dakota. Lieutenant Flynn faces charges of adultery, lying to investigators, and disobeying an order in connection with two love affairs the Air Force says she had, one with a married civilian. The case of 26-year-old Lieutenant Flynn has not only highlighted the military's tough rules against adultery and certain types of romantic relationships, but also the way those rules are applied. Many victims and women's groups say that the rules are disproportionately applied to women. Joining us right now to talk about this is Todd Ensign, the head of Citizen Soldier, an advocacy group for service people based in New York City. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Todd.
It's good to be here again.
Well, why don't you go through Kelly Flynn's story first, because I don't think a lot of people actually know what this case is about and what she is charged with.
Kelly Flynn is really someone who would be considered an absolute primo military officer. She comes out of the Air Force Academy. She won her flight wings and is flying, the first female being allowed to fly a B-52. So she's somebody that the Air Force normally would look to for future leadership. And apparently she got involved with a couple different men, one of whom was an enlisted person, not in her chain of command, had no duties related to the bomb wing. The second relationship was with a man who's a civilian who happened to be married, but according to her, told her that he was legally separated. He also was on probation for wife abuse in North Dakota, so obviously in some ways a pretty unsavory character. Hoodwinked her, I think. She was young, as we all are at one point in our lives, gullible, and made a couple mistakes. And from our view at Citizen Soldier, they are just dropping, it's a proverbial shotgun on a flea. I mean, they are just hammering this woman. They've set her up on charges. This whole business about lying, I was on a show last night with Colonel Harry Summers, and he starts in about how she lied under oath. It's now become oath. These are OSI cops, you know, civilian investigators, who came to her and said, all right, Flynn, what the hell's going on with this guy? She's frightened. She sees 10 years of her life on the line. She says, we're just friends. That's what she said. And for this, they're saying lying. And Summers also said last night, how can you trust a woman to fly a nuclear-armed B-52 around the world if she will lie under oath? And, you know, I think the answer to that is you look at Tailhook, and you've got a situation where the pilots are the premier carrier pilots. They are in Las Vegas running wild, running amok. And what you've got is them, no one's saying about them, they can't fly planes anymore just because they haven't the right to behave in a group of women.
Well, the amazing thing is that in the military, Todd, where obviously where you find any military base, you inevitably find not only nightclubs and bars and houses of prostitution and so forth, that it has been part of the military culture throughout the world for married servicemen as well as unmarried servicemen to engage in sexual activities or adultery. For this pilot to be singled out, to me, is amazing. I mean, this is amazing that this is even going on.
Well, exactly. I was talking with an elderly former military Army lawyer who was in the military in the 50s through the 60s. He said in his 20 years as a lawyer, he never tried an adultery case in 20 years in the Army. And as you said, in Korea, for example, there was a controversy in the 70s because the GIs used to run ads for yobos. When they would leave after a year there, they'd run an ad in the base newspaper for their wife, for a new guy coming in, and they pay money. This was a scandal at that time. This still goes on in Korea. This is a one-year unaccompanied tour. People hook up with these women. They come home. No one says anything. Why is Kelly Flynn and Krista Davis and these other women being singled out? The only explanation, in our view, can be gender bias and misogyny.
You just said Krista Davis. Explain this case, the classmate of Kelly Flynn.
Krista Davis is a black lieutenant who is serving at Barksdale Air Force Base in Louisiana. She got involved with a major, a superior to her. He happened to be black. He happened to be married, but again, told her he was legally separated. She got involved with him. The military didn't like it. Since then, they've piled charges on her. He, by the way, has never been charged with adultery. In fact, he's being allowed to resign from the Air Force.
And she's had a child now.
And she's had a child, which she tried to get him to help her pay for. They issued a no-contact order. The same thing with Kelly Flynn, saying, you must have no further contact with this person. That's the kind of part people don't realize. The power of the military justice system gives these commanders. And that's why they can destroy people over something that most of us would consider private business, off-base, off-duty, consensual business.
How has the Secretary of the Air Force, Sheila Widnall, now is a woman, how do you think she has reacted to this compared to previous top Air Force or Army commanders?
She has been a disaster as a secretary. In fact, it's not time here now, but the whole Clinton administration has been terrible on the issue of civilian control of the military. Clinton, because of the whole draft dodger thing, has let the military override him on every single issue. It's not just a gay rights ban. It's every single issue. And Widnall's been terrible. In other words, she defers every single time to her commanders.
So tell us right now what Kelly Flynn is asking for. In the last few days, she said she would go for an honorable discharge, although she was extremely unhappy about it. I was watching her, I think, on 60 Minutes. She was crying as she said this. But it seemed that that's what the military had been offering her if she wanted to avoid the court-martial. Now they're saying no.
Well, it may be they were playing games with her lawyers. That certainly goes on with them. Obviously, to give her an honorable discharge would be to admit that this whole proceeding has been unjust and unfair. The Air Force is not about to do that. They would give her a general discharge, I believe. And it might be wise, you know, we're not involved in her case, but it might be wise for her to take it because I don't think there's much doubt. She's made a lot of admissions. There's not much doubt this court-martial jury is going to convict her. And she's facing 9 years in prison, along with a dishonorable dismissal, which is really bad news.
We're talking to Todd Ensign, who is head of Citizen Soldier, which is a service person's advocacy group based here in New York City.
What is this doing to the whole issue of the role of women in the U.S. military? Obviously, we've just had the incredibly wrenching experiences of the rape allegations and the trials and a lot of basic training. What is happening right now with women in the military, and what does this signal, the Flynn case, sending to women around the country?
Well, I think the military has still been unable to integrate women into the military. Remember, only 10 years ago, women were not performing any critical roles within the military. This has all been, pilots have only been the last few years. Women aboard battleships has only been the last few years. And I think, you know, the military is a very traditional institution. Look at Tailhook in 91. There was a situation where pilots, Navy pilots, were running amok, attacking women, tearing their clothes off, pissing on them. It was an incredible scene. Not a single person was court-martialed out of that. That tells you something about the male-dominated hierarchical view they have of themselves. Now, people were punished in other ways, and some people were retired and that sort of thing. But no one was put on trial. Why? Because the last thing they wanted was to bring all that evidence out under oath before the national jury. That would be terrible. So they didn't do it. So they still cannot really accept women. Women are still treated, I think most women, honestly, off the record in the military would tell you this, that they still feel they have to work twice as hard, be twice as careful and twice as diligent to get the recognition that men get.
Do you have any actual figures on the number of women who have been court-martialed versus the number of men who have been court-martialed in the military for sexual activity? And we have to separate this from sexual harassment.
Exactly. Yes. In fraternization in the Air Force this year, 97, five women have been court-martialed for fraternization. That's where an enlisted person has an involvement with an officer. Seven men in the same period. That would, because women are only 15% of the military, obviously women are four times more likely to be prosecuted than men for fraternization. Adultery is way up, too. By the way, fraternization this year represents as many as the last 3 years, so it's way up. Adultery, same thing. 10 years ago, adultery's quadrupled in the last decade. Now, in the adultery area, men are prosecuted at a proportion the same as their numbers in the military. So there I don't think it's as clear. But I think that they're sending a message to these women, you successful, independent, outspoken types, you better watch your step because we are still here, we still have the power, and we will smash you.
And it's a clear message because this woman is a symbol. She is the country's first female B-52 bomber pilot.
Let me just go back to Krista Davis' case for a minute because it's really shocking what's going on there. The New York Daily News story today only had some of the details. She had a commander, this was a major, who told her and other women on several occasions that in his opinion, women from the Air Force Academy constituted a coven of witches. That was a quote he used several times. It was a witch's coven who used sexual harassment complaints as a way of getting their way in the military. The other thing he said, which was particularly outrageous to her as a black woman, one day he was talking about Clarence Page, the black columnist, and he said, "That boy needs a good old-fashioned Mississippi ass whooping," which she took as almost tantamount to calling for a lynching. Now, that's outrageous that a superior officer to her would be talking like that. She's filed formal charges against him and asked for an Inspector General report, and that's when they brought down the boom on her. That's what all these Mickey Mouse charges are about in her case.
And what is the status of her case right now?
Well, next month, she will have her kind of grand jury hearing, the Article 32, where they will decide if they're going ahead with these charges. She's facing 55 years in prison.
55
and,
years.
And she's a young black mother with a five-month-old baby.
55 years. Well, maybe this will get the man to pay some child support if she's in prison. my God. Well, so what do you expect to see today in the trial?
Well, she, as I said earlier, she's made a number of admissions on the air. She said on ABC yesterday morning that she had lied to the investigators. That would not have been my advice to make their job easier, but for whatever reason, that's what she's chosen to do, probably because she's just throwing herself on the mercy of them, and the problem is they really have no mercy. Once you cross the line with the military, you're on the other side. They are merciless. You become them, and we're us.
And no one has yet put President Clinton on the spot on this issue, since he's so expert in this issue of adultery and scandalous behavior, but he's been kind of silent on this question, hasn't he?
Well, I said earlier, he has just, in his 6 years, he has let the military run amok. Even today with his quadrennial review,
because he's afraid to...
He is, because of the draft resistor thing, and probably because he's just a right-wing military good old boy, too, he has just let them get away with murder. And this case here, these cases show the same pattern.
Let's not forget, President Clinton is the commander-in-chief. And, of course, we see this also with gays in the military, with gay men and lesbians. This whole attack on their sexual activity in the military has actually increased under President Clinton.
And, again, he's silent. Remember, he said, no matter what comes out of the don't ask, don't tell rules, I will ensure that we do not have, it does not redound to their detriment. That's what he promised when he issued those rules. You know, he's the commander-in-chief. He could change those rules today if he wanted to. He could also drop these prosecutions today if he wanted to. So zero leadership. He's scared to death of that brass. He won't stand up to them, and they are powerful bullies.
Todd Ensign, if people want to get in touch with Citizen Soldier in New York City, the group that you are head of, the advocacy group for service members, how can they reach you?
Well, they can write us, 175 Fifth Avenue, New York, 10010, and call us, 679-2250. We're also in the Manhattan White Pages. We would certainly like to hear, especially from people who are on active duty or having similar problems, we'd certainly like to hear from you, and maybe we can give you some assistance.
Again, the main phone number?
679-212-679-2250.
Thank you very much for being with us.
I enjoyed it.
Todd Ensign of Citizen Soldier. And before we go to the break, we wanted to just get a few minutes in with a very interesting group in Washington that is suing the Central Intelligence Agency. The Federation of American Scientists is suing the CIA to force it to reveal one of Washington's worst-kept secrets, the size of the budget for American espionage. Joining us right now to talk about this is Stephen Aftergood, and he's director of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy. Welcome to Democracy Now, Stephen.
Thank you.
Well, tell us what this suit is all about.
Well, the question of how much we spend on intelligence has been controversial literally for decades. The Church Committee in the 1970s, which conducted a famous investigation of U.S. intelligence policy, recommended that the total intelligence budget be released to the public, so that taxpayers can know how much of their money is being devoted to intelligence. It has been controversial ever since then. There have been efforts made to disclose the size of the budget. It has been offered as an amendment in Congress for each of the last five or so years. Most recently, actually last year, President Clinton, following up on a year-long official commission to study intelligence policy, President Clinton declared that, yes, the budget number, that is the total amount of money we spend on intelligence, could be safely declassified without damage to national security, and that, in fact, it should be declassified in order to help inform the public about the sensitive matters of intelligence. So that gave us an opening. We thought, hey, the president has said it can be safely declassified. Let's go ahead and ask for it. And, of course, we did that last fall, and CIA came back and said, oh, no, it's classified. And there is such a clear contrast between the president's stated position and the CIA's refusal to budge, that we think we have an unusually strong legal position. Now, we were just talking about the question of the president's leadership with respect to military matters. I would note that the president did not, in fact, declassify the number himself. He merely said it could be declassified, and he invited Congress to go ahead and do so. Now, Congress to its shame, in my opinion, voted down, that is, rejected an amendment to declassify the budget last fall. So, and they said if the president wants it, he should declassify it.
Stephen Aftergood, we have to break, but we want to come back and just ask you
a
few specific questions. Then we're going to look at the military's plans for the 21st century. Steve Aftergood, director of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy, the FAS, Federation of American Scientists, is suing the CIA to disclose their budget. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we're just finishing our conversation up with Stephen Aftergood, director of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy. His group is suing the Central Intelligence Agency to reveal the size of the spy budget.
Well, Stephen Aftergood, I don't understand. The president says it can be revealed, and the CIA refuses to. They don't listen to the president. He's not giving them a direct order. What is the problem in terms of actually, and we're only talking here about bottom line figures. We're not talking about specifics, right?
Correct. Yes, I mean, basically the president made a very waffly kind of statement that it could be declassified, but he did not order that it be declassified. So that, I think, gives us a strong standing to bring the issue to the judicial branch and say, look at this contradiction and give us the budget number.
I think this is happening at the same time. There's a piece in the New York Times on the same page as the story about your suit, also by Tim Weiner, who actually won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting on the black budget, that secret hidden budget of the Pentagon and the CIA that has never been revealed. But he's got another piece.
Of course, I think he was at the Philadelphia Inquirer when he won that Pulitzer, not at the Times.
He wrote this other piece saying that the CIA's years-old promise to release records on its most famous covert operations of the Cold War are merely a brilliant public relations snow job and a carefully nurtured myth, according to a historian who served for 6 years on a CIA panel that helps in the declassifying of the agency's data. And we do hope to get that academic, George Herring, on, who's a professor at the University of Kentucky, who says he feels like he was used to create the impression that the agency is serious about fulfilling promises of openness made since 1992 by successive CIA directors. So it doesn't look like this historian is faring much better than you did in terms of getting the Central Intelligence Agency to be open, Stephen.
We hope that the advantage that we have is the judicial system and that we can bring the force of law to bear on this issue.
Well, we thank you very much for joining us. And for people who want to get in touch with the Federation of American Scientists, where can they call or go on the web?
The best way to find us is on the World Wide Web. Our address is www.fas.org, and you can find there more than you wanted to know.
That's fas.org.
Yes.
Stephen Aftergood has been with us, director of the Federation of American Scientists Project on Government Secrecy, again suing the CIA today to get them to say how much their budget is. Well, you're listening to Democracy Now!, and speaking of budgets, we turn now to the Pentagon. Yesterday, it unveiled its strategic blueprint for the 21st century. Secretary of Defense William Cohen announced a new round of base closings and cuts in service personnel. But he actually increased the Pentagon's budget for new weapons system, a big boon to defense contractors. The procurement budget will reportedly increase from $40 billion a year to $60 billion a year by 2002. Joining us to talk right now about this issue are two people. William Hartung is a senior research fellow with the World Policy Institute, an independent think tank that examines U.S. foreign and economic policy. And we're joined by Dave Vedas. He is director of the Aerospace Research Center at the Aerospace Industries Association, which is a trade lobbying group in Washington, D.C. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Morning.
Well, why don't we start with Dave Vedas? What is your reaction to Bill Cohen's review and what he released yesterday?
Well, on balance, I mean, we see it as a positive move. You know, let me say first that DOD is sort of in between a rock and a hard place. For the last 10 years, overall defense spending has fallen quite dramatically, and at the same point in time, they've had to prepare for fighting two major regional conflicts, plus humanitarian aid, plus peaceful deployment of troops in a lot of different areas. And as a result, they've been reducing defense spending. And certainly after the Cold War, there has been a need to reduce defense spending to some degree. But through that process, the procurement and the research and development accounts, which are the accounts that most matter on our industry, they've dropped by over 60%, which is quite substantial. And as a result, our own companies have had to go through some very difficult times in trying to adjust to that declining defense spending. And you know, now we're at a budget, I guess, where we have about a $44 billion procurement spending for our defense companies. And based on what we've done in terms of going from 8 airframe companies down to 3, based on what we've done in terms of going from 12 missile companies down to 4 and 4 helicopter companies down to 3, there's really not very much further we can go, particularly on the prime level, because you know, our companies, in effect, are private companies like all U.S. industry, and they have to demonstrate to investors that they can grow. And so they must do things that will allow investors some type of return. And it's very difficult under defense spending that continues to fall to the degree that it's been falling to attract investors. So they still see some difficult times ahead if defense spending continues to fall further. So at least seeing that maybe we've reached the bottom here is a positive factor for our industry. And one other point also that should be made is that you know, you can't turn aerospace or defense capabilities on or off like a light switch. It takes years to have a program go from conception all the way to finally fielding that program. For instance, the F-22 began with information exchange from DOD and industry in 1981, and it won't be fielded in operational numbers until the year 2005, and the total production run won't finish until the year 2009. So you really have to look far out in advance in terms of modernization questions. You can't just wait until all of a sudden, boom, hey, we need this product right now and we need to field it now. It takes time to get from point A to point B.
But Dave Vedas, some critics of the current budget would say that the budget calls for 900 new F-22s and F-18s for the Air Force and the Navy. Who are we going to fight with all of these planes? I mean, the disintegration of the Soviet bloc means that there is no credible threat to the United States, to the security of the United States, certainly to interests around the world, it may be. The budget has dropped, but the threat to the United States has disintegrated almost completely.
Well, I think what basically DOD is facing is, and I think Congress also agrees, is this potential two major regional conflicts fighting almost simultaneously. And based on that scenario, I think they were figuring probably 200 F-22s in one theater and 200 F-22s in another theater, which they feel is probably the bare minimum they could take. And, you know, I can't, you know, one of the difficult processes is, you know, before during the Cold War, it was easy. You had the Soviet Union, and they were easy to target and easy to set up defenses to try to contain. Now the potential threats are not as easily defined, but certainly we know that we have some potential problems in the Middle East and North Korea. So,
Hartung, let me get your reaction to this, to these continued needs.
Well, I think he's missing the point, and you know, it may not be surprising he's trying to defend the interests of his industry. But as Juan indicated, we're in a totally different world now. The United States didn't fight two major regional conflicts even during the Cold War. In the years of Korea, Vietnam, the arms race with the Soviet Union. Maybe once every 15 years there would be a major regional conflict. The two big countries we're supposed to be scared of, Iraq and North Korea, are substantially weaker than they were even 5 years ago. There's starvation going on in North Korea. Their military is weaker than South Korea as it is. Our jet fighters that we currently have are better than anything else in the world and are likely to be so for the next 20 years. We've got the three biggest air forces in the world. We've got one sitting out in the desert in Arizona gathering rust in a place called the Boneyard, stuff that's being given away for surplus. We've got one that exists with our Air Force and Navy, and we've got one that we're buying now. And there's no country in the world that can match that, has no prospect to do so. This is really not a quadrennial defense review. This is a military contractor bailout. And, you know, I really don't feel great sympathy for Lockheed Martin and McDonnell Douglas. Yes, the industry has consolidated into a few big companies, and those companies are making record profits. This has very little to do with defending the country. It has a lot to do with the history of Bill Cohen and Bill Clinton. As was mentioned before, Clinton is afraid to take on the military. Bill Cohen is, when he was in the Congress, got tens of thousands of dollars from military contractors, voted for every military spending increase in the last 2 years, helped them give subsidies to export more weapons around the world. You know, I think this is an indication that Bill Cohen is really setting up his next career move, that when he finishes as defense secretary, he can go work for the Aerospace Industries Association or Lockheed Martin, and they will be very grateful for the service that he's done for them.
Or perhaps become president.
Well, you know, anything's possible in this country.
Well, Dave Vadas, a military contractor bailout?
I wouldn't call it military contractor bailout, certainly. Point one I wanted to make is that it's not my position here to either approve or disapprove of the current military strategy that's out there. I'm just saying that it exists, and that is a strategy from which DOD, the executive branch, and Congress are both dealing with. And in effect, it's from that strategy that the defense industrial base has to supply capability to. So, you know, I just want to make that position clear. And secondly, if we've done so good under Clinton, then how come our defense spending has continued to fall? We've been, in terms of the federal budget, and this actually occurs before Clinton, but we've gone from something like 28% down to 15% of the overall federal budget. So it's in terms of overall priorities of spending, and that's the overall DOD budget, I don't think we've really fared that well in terms of being in anyone's pocket. I think that we've had a very difficult time recently. And the main point I'm just trying to make here is that, you know, you said we had record props. I think if you look at the stock market recently, aerospace stocks and defense stocks have underperformed the market since the new budget has been submitted. And where it's going to go from here, we'll just have to see. But our companies are, as I mentioned before, are private companies, just like any other companies, and they have to grow. And if they don't grow, they're either going to have to merge with another company or get into another business. And that's just sort of the bottom line. But I will also say that our products are the best in the world, and we try to provide DOD with the best capability that they can obtain. And we've proved that in the Gulf War.
In terms of the budget also assumes that there would be a dozen aircraft carrier battle groups around the world. Again, could you tell us something about what the rationale for needing that many carrier groups around the world would be?
Is that directed to me?
Yes.
Here again, you're asking me specifics about military doctrine, and that's not really something that I'm in the best position to discuss. I'm, from the industry's point of view, just trying to discuss where the budget's going in terms of our corporate interests versus military strategy.
You know, it's interesting because strategy can really not be separated from corporate interests, because we've seen in case after case that the strategy is often determined by what the aerospace industry wants. For example, the whole sale of fighter planes to Latin America was as a result of a many years campaign of tremendous lobbying from organizations like in your trade group, putting a lot of pressure on, well, William Cohen, on President Clinton to open up Latin America to U.S. military weapons.
I'll try to address that just briefly, too. I think one of the issues that we have to look at whenever there's any type of sale overseas, the government has to weigh political, economic, and military interests that are at stake. And in terms of the potential sales to Chile, I think our government has to sit there and weigh and say, okay, are we better off in those three categories if another country sells those products to Chile? If Chile wants those particular products, and there are multiple companies out there from different countries that's supplying similar type products, Chile's going to buy it. If they don't buy it from us, they'll buy it from somebody else. If they buy it from us, then at least the U.S. in this particular situation would have greater political and military influence on Chile in terms of how those particular pieces of equipment are deployed, training involved, resupply, the weapons that are given.
Dave Adas is with the Aerospace Industries Association. I want to get Bill Hartung's response to that with the World Policy Institute.
Well, that argument could be used to arm Saddam Hussein, to arm communist China, to arm any government in the world. If you're going to say, well, they might buy it from somebody else, so we might as well sell it to them, that's a completely immoral and unconscionable basis on which to make policy. What we should be doing is limiting arms sales to these regions and pressuring other countries to do the same. And when that was done on the issue of landmines, when the U.S. Senate took the lead and banned exports of landmines from this country, 24 other countries joined in. If the United States is going to say they're going to get it somewhere, they might as well get it from us. Basically, you have a recipe for disaster. What we're going to be doing is what we've done for the last 10 years. We've supplied weapons to 39 of the 42 active conflicts in the world. We've got companies like Lockheed Martin saying the reason we need the F-22 is because so many other countries have advanced fighter planes. Well, where do you think they got those? From the United States, of course. So we're in a position where we're actually running an arms race with ourselves because of this permissive export policy. And then the industry turns around innocently to the Congress and the president says, gee, we need more money because it's a threatening world out there. But, of course, the lobbying strategies and the pressure, the political pressure by this industry has made it a more dangerous world. And now they want to profit from it yet again by building more expensive weapons and getting U.S. taxpayers to pick up the tab.
Can I just respond to that real quickly?
Sure.
I just wanted to say, as I mentioned up front in answering that question, that U.S. policymakers weigh every decision in terms of exports, in terms of foreign policy, political, military, and then also economic considerations.
When you say economic, do you mean the contributions that the politicians get?
No, I don't mean that. That's not part of the equation. The equation that
so
I'm
referring
to is...
So why do you make the contributions if they don't have an effect?
We're
why
talking
why
about...
Stop doing
they're
it?
Not making contributions to people within the executive branch, and those are the people who bring up the proposals to begin with.
Well, maybe you should do your research. You know, soft money, that's what that's all about. You help the Democratic Party, which helps reelect the president. Your industry gave record soft money contributions in the last election. Maybe you should do some research on that.
What I know is that our country has a greater review process than any country in the world in terms of, and more openness of any country in the world in terms of reviewing a specific sale, and all sales are reviewed in an intra-agency environment that allows State, Commerce, the CIA, DOD, and the President himself to review a particular sale, weighing a lot of these decisions, and then that particular proposal has to go to Congress and has to be approved by Congress before that sale goes and actually occurs.
On that note, we have to wrap up, but I do want to ask Bill Hartung of the World Policy Institute, if people want to get in touch with your group, how can they reach you?
We're at 212-229-5808.
And how also do we get in touch with you, Dave Adas, with the Aerospace Industries Association?
Yes, I'm at 202-371-8562.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us as we just begin this discussion of the military's plans for the next century. If you'd like to get a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Andy York engineered the show in Washington. Our engineer in New York and assistant producer is Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!